refuse to believe that the Bank of Justice is bankrupt. We refuse to believe that there are insufficient funds in the great vaults of opportunity of this nation. So we've come to cash this check,
yes.
A check that will give us upon demand the riches of freedom and the security of justice.
I'm Serge Antonin. Black and White and Thin Blue Lines is an original podcast co-created by Clark Ollers and me.
Welcome to another episode of Black and White and Thin Blue Lines. My name is Clark Ollers.
And I'm Serge Antonin.
Before we begin our discussion on the topic of characteristics of an armed person, I would like to briefly speak to a personal matter. My mother, Catherine Ollers, who was known her entire life by the name Cass, K-A-S-S, passed away on Monday, May 15th, 2023. At her funeral, I gave the eulogy, and I'm just so honored Serge was a pallbearer. I'm posting her eulogy on our website under What We Are Reading and Writing. If you ever wish to remember Cass, please read a book with a child. My mother was a reading teacher who taught me to read and write and introduced me, my brother Mike, and my late sister Kate to a lifetime love of books and literature. My late father John started his professional life as a news reporter, and he cultivated my love of the news and my addiction to newspapers and great reporting, and he is the reason I appreciate great journalism when I find it. On a second introductory note, Serge, what did you learn from a listener about last week's podcast, which was called Death on the F Train, about the Daniel Penny, Jordan Neely case in New York?
Well, I was speaking to a listener who was a former Marine, and he heard the episode, and one of his suggestions when we began to just kind of talk about it and the incident, one of his suggestions was that as a Marine who has seen time overseas and in forward areas, that one of his concerns would have been that the decedent, Mr. Jordan Neely, right? Jordan
yes.
Neely could have been armed with a bomb of some sort. While that was not something that I ever even thought about, it's something to think about when we ride these subways here in America and anywhere, really. We've kind of, in America, we're a little bit more relaxed on subways, but we've seen in foreign countries where people get on these subways and go into public markets and such, strapped with bombs. Now, with that said, though, I don't know how much good a chokehold would do against a suicide bomber, but anything could happen. And people who are religious zealots or zealots of any kind are from every walk of life and race, as we've learned in recent times. So something to think about, I guess, as we go forward in that Neely Penny case in New York City.
Serge, when you told me the thoughts of that former Marine, the first thing that just occurred to me, kind of jumped off the page at me, was that Daniel Penny, of course, is a former Marine.
Yes.
Meaning,
and that's kind of why I brought it up.
Right, and he served overseas.
Mm-hmm.
And I did think it was a very interesting point also with what the man was saying. I'm not afraid to die and so on and so forth. Just like we're going to talk today about the Shipley Hill shooting, I'm sure the Marines get special training on Allah Akbar, for example. You know, those words might have special meaning to a Marine in a forward operating area.
Yes.
So now we're going to begin our discussion of today's topic, which is the Shipley Hill shooting. The basic facts are that on Thursday, May 11th, 2023, during the daylight hours, a 17-year-old whose name is now been published, I'm just going to use his first initial M, his last name is Franklin, and there's a 3-minute video posted on the YouTube and other places on the internet, and it shows Police Commissioner Michael Harrison in a press conference about the incident, but in my mind, more importantly, it shows the body-worn camera of Detective Cedric Ellaby, who is the detective who ultimately shot the 17-year-old. Police officers at the press conference following the shooting told reporters that the 17-year-old had a bulge near his waistband. The detective on the body-worn camera, he attempts to detain the young man for a moment, presumably to do a frisk, when the young man ran. The young man was pursued and shot by Ella B. after he, in my notes I wrote the word displayed, but let me just characterize it. He reaches into his waistband and he has the gun in his right hand pointed down, and the gun proves to be a Smith & Wesson 9mm with an extended magazine.
And as, I guess, comic relief in this situation, it was only outfitted with 4 rounds in the magazine.
Right, although the magazine could have held 20 rounds.
Yes.
Right. The detective was, or is rather, a member of the Baltimore Police Department since 2019. He was assigned to something called the Direct Action Team, which is really subsequent to the old Gun Trace Task Force. The gun itself was stolen from a vehicle in the Western District of Baltimore in 2021. Criminals have a way of getting guns. As an aside, before we get into the nitty-gritty of this matter, you know, as our listeners, that we have frequently discussed body-worn cameras, and I found it very interesting that there were a number of witness accounts in the news, quoted in the Sun papers, WJZ TV, and so forth, where witnesses reported that the young man, they did not see him to have a gun. When you look at the body-worn camera, there is no doubt, at least in my mind, that Mr. Franklin pulled a Smith & Wesson 9mm with an extended magazine from his waistband and was running with it in his right hand at the time of the shooting. Now, on the day of the incident, a deputy police commissioner of the Baltimore Police Department made a statement that the suspect had, quote, the characteristics of an armed person, end quote. Shortly after the deputy police commissioner made this statement, a news reporter misquoted the commissioner and said that he had said the suspect had the, quote, traits of an armed person, end quote.
So I understand where people were coming from, but what I think he truly meant, and what I believe the commissioner Michael Harrison said at a later date, was that he displayed characteristics of an armed person. And I think that if he had said it that way and explained exactly what those characteristics may have been, the public can understand it better. Like, for instance, when I was going through the academy, I don't know if they teach it anymore, there was a whole block of instruction on characteristics of an armed person. And once you see it in live action, you begin to understand what you're looking for. Like, for instance, I'll give a few examples that were characteristics of or behaviors of an armed person. Like, for instance, something, if a person's carrying a gun or some kind of weapon that may be heavy and it's tucked in their waistband or somewhere, they may security check it, meaning check to make sure that it's secure, not falling, that it's there, especially if they're not used to carrying the weapon. They may want to check, make sure it's covered because it's usually concealed. So that's something called a security check, or an unnatural gait. Sometimes when carrying a weapon, it affects the way you walk, whether it's a mental thing, or if you're carrying, let's say, a rifle or a shotgun, or even if you were carrying a club that was stowed somewhere on your person, it may affect the way you walk, which is something that, and kind of to stop here to clarify, it's something that people who are in police, security, military, it's a skill. It's almost like an art form, and it's something that has to be honed, because you can't say to yourself that you expect police or security to effectively do their job if they don't possess certain skills. And this is a skill, like a visual scan for weapons or contraband. That's a skill, something that needs to be honed, taught, then honed. And usually it's honed because of experience. And not only experience, but I always talk about this backpack of knowledge that people in any profession have to carry, because it's an imaginary backpack, but you have to tuck your experiences and your stories from other people in your profession in this backpack, because you don't necessarily have to, how do we say, observe every cautionary tale with your own two eyes to learn from it.
Obviously, this police detective, Ellaby, correctly saw suspiciousness, something suspicious that proved to be a loaded handgun.
Absolutely. And I think a lot of times we like to play around in the weeds. I think that that's where the discussion really needs to stop. Once you say you've observed it and it is so, what do we need to keep talking for? Now, if you say I observed it and it's not so, then you're like, well, why'd you stop the person? Then they've got answering to do. But if your observations were keen enough and they're accurate, then what are we really talking about? But the next, okay, I've discussed security check, unnatural gait. Now the next is a jacket sag. Like if someone's carrying a weapon in a pocket of their clothing, their outer garment, it will tend to sag to one side.
Because the weapons are heavy.
Absolutely. Unfortunately, they could also be carrying a bundle of keys, because I know me, sometimes in my rain jacket, I may carry a bundle of keys, and the last thing I do is carry a gun in my outer garment pocket, but it'll tend to make my jacket sag to one side. So sometimes I even display characteristics of an armed person. Another thing is a hunchback stride that is displayed oftentimes when people are secreting a shotgun or some kind of a long gun, bulges and an outline or possible outline of a weapon on your waistband. But see, here's the funny thing, Clark, because even though I'm not a policeman anymore, I'm still always, especially, you know, I have small kids. Whenever we go out, I'm always on alert. First thing you almost always recognize is a knife in one's pocket because of the clips and all. But when people carry their phones under their shirts, the tail end of a phone can also mimic the print of a gun at times.
In fact, Serge, I go a step further. There are people who have phone carriers, leather phone carriers.
Yes.
And I've seen them come out of the bottom of a shirt and thought I was seeing a holster.
Absolutely.
This issue about police officers going up to people to try to stop them momentarily and frisk them, this goes back to before 1968. In 1968, the United States Supreme Court, in a really famous case, Terry v. Ohio, found at 392 U.S. 1, held that under the Fourth Amendment of the United States Constitution, a police officer may stop a suspect on the street and frisk him or her without probable cause to arrest if the police officer has a reasonable suspicion that the person has committed, is committing, or future tense, is about to commit a crime and has a reasonable belief that the person may be armed and presently dangerous. I'm just going to break that down for just a moment. For our listeners, if you think of a continuum from left to right, with left being 0% evidence and the right side being 100% mind of God certainty, probable cause would be halfway up the continuum, roughly 50%. If it's more likely than not that a person's committing a crime, then you would have the right to arrest them. And what Terry v. Ohio says is you don't have to have that 50% or 50.1%. You can have reasonable suspicion, meaning it's not just a speculation on your part. You can articulate what it is. And Serge just told our listeners, seven signs that a weapon's being...
Well, I haven't finished. I've got two left. No, that's fine.
Okay, but five of the seven signs that a weapon's being concealed. And the point being that the law, at least in 1968, to, I'm going to be a little bit sarcastic here, unless until the Department of Justice imposed a consent decree on the Baltimore City Police Department, the law of the United States permitted Detective Ellaby to do what he was in the act of doing in West Baltimore.
And I'm glad you brought that up, but let me finish out the round out the list. And number six, obviously, is a weapon being visible. I mean, that's pretty much a no-brainer. And lastly, palming, which could be somewhat, well, that's probably would be more prevalent in terms of dealing with a bladed weapon, a knife of some sort, or a handgun that's small enough for someone with really large hands to be able to just put it in the palm of their hand and put their hand in such a way, either against their leg or with the pistol facing the rear, that you wouldn't be able to see it. But back to what Clark – oh, and let me just – one more thing. When you were discussing the backpacks, one of the things people are doing more now in modern day, and I'd say within the last maybe 5 to 6 years, is carrying these weapons in fanny packs draped across their chests. And one of the reasons they're doing so is because things like the consent decree have put a kibosh on the stop and frisk. And I'm glad you brought up that Supreme Court case, because the whole ideas of characteristics of the armed person and the stop and frisk really go hand in hand. And I know when I started policing, when the stop and frisk was a big deal, you stopped and frisked based upon your certain observations. Now, did cops start to abuse that and say maybe they saw something that they didn't? And then if there was no weapon found, they kind of just no harm, no fouled it, in which case a lot of complaints started getting generated. And as we see across the country, the stop and frisk is no more a popular item on the police investigative list, but it's very valuable, especially when it's not abused. And unfortunately, here in America, with race being a huge issue, especially in these some of these really violent communities that happen to be predominantly African American, it becomes a big issue, and the stop and frisk has become widely abused, and now it's no longer permitted in a lot of cases.
I would advocate that even if stop and frisk has been abused in the past, it is a constitutionally permitted tool of the police that must necessarily be brought back, because I really do think that the law-abiding citizens gain nothing from the consent decree, other than theoretically they're less likely to be improperly temporarily seized and frisked by a police officer. I get that. Nobody wants that to happen.
And I feel like I agree with you 100%. And to piggyback on that, I feel like if the citizens are armed with knowledge, like if a police officer were to stop you because your jacket was sagging on one side in Columbia Mall, and in it you had your phone and a wad of keys, you'd have no problem explaining to him, once he explained to you, what his probable cause was.
By the way, actually, in fact, that's actually a good point. Under Maryland law, Maryland has a statute that kind of puts into effect the constitutional decision in Terry v. Ohio. Mm-hmm. And what it says is a police officer is first to attempt to allay his suspicion, meaning to satisfy his suspicion by inquiry.
Absolutely.
And so I think that, for example, if I did have I was walking through Columbia Mall with an outer jacket on, it was sagging, police officer stopped me. First, common sense, I would not be reaching into my pocket quickly.
Absolutely.
For any reason. But secondly, I would have no, first of all, I'd actually be impressed that the police officer was paying close attention, which would, you know, I would actually be impressed with that. But in any event, no, I'd have no problem at all saying what's going on.
I actually have an anecdote, Clark Ellis. Can I?
Sure.
Present my anecdote?
Sure.
So I have a good friend who also happened to be a police officer, and we were working a robbery, was it a robbery initiative or was it just holiday deployment? One of the things you begin to see is that certain times of the year, you see certain crime trends. Like during the holidays and when it gets cold around Christmas, robberies go up. It's just inevitable because people are wearing more clothes there.
Including robberies of pedestrians.
Yeah, that's more my point. Street robberies is what I'm talking about.
Okay.
So we were deployed. I think we might have been working a crime suppression in an overtime capacity. And I was driving. He's in the passenger seat. And I observe a gentleman, African-American, and he dips into an alley. So I kill the lights. I follow him into the alley. Get out. Use some strong verbal commands. He stopped. I immediately asked him if he was armed with anything. And he was very cooperative. And that's another sign if you're a cop. Sometimes when people are overly cooperative, can be a sign that they might be armed or have some other type of contraband. So anyway, I said, look, buddy, I observed you kind of walking with this weird, almost limp. You know, you're armed. You mind if my partner and I check you out? He was like, no, I'm not armed. And he said, I walk with a limp because I have a prosthetic leg. Sure enough, we check him out. He doesn't mind us patting him. We wrote the stop and frisk afterwards, but we pat him down. Sure enough, one of his legs was fake. It was a fake leg. But during the pat down, out of his pocket comes marijuana. And I don't know if he had his hand in his pocket and when he pulled his hands
out. I'm hoping the story goes you had to give him a break on the marijuana.
Well, here's the deal. Okay. It's funny that you say that. You know me more than our listeners do. So it falls to the ground, and he looks at me, and he says, well, I guess I'm still going to jail. I said, well, for littering if you don't pick that up. And he was like, thank you, officer, thank you. And I said, trust me, this was probably 15 years ago, but I was like, if anybody needs that, you need it. Have a good night. And along you went. But my point was, he presented characteristics of an armed person. And because in the area we had had some street robberies, I'd had every reason to stop him and investigate. And it turned out to be the, you know, perfect anecdote for the podcast. But the outcome was perfect. Nobody got hurt. No harm, no foul.
I want to tell our listeners about two other aspects that I think, aspects of the law, which I think further complicate the decision-making about the Baltimore City shooting that we're discussing. The first is Tennessee versus Garner, a case decided by the Supreme Court in 1985. In that case, the holding of the Supreme Court was that under the Fourth Amendment of the United States Constitution, a police officer may use deadly force to prevent the escape of a fleeing suspect. I'm going to stop for just a moment. There's no question that Detective Ellaby used deadly force. Now, thankfully, the 17-year-old has survived to date.
Now, is that fleeing suspect or fleeing felon?
Suspect.
Okay, I was just curious.
Yeah, that's what I want to bring up.
Okay.
And it's suspect only if the officer has a good faith belief that the suspect poses a significant threat of death or serious physical injury to the officer or others. Now, in Tennessee v. Garner, they upheld the shooting of a burglar, a housebreaking. And I remember at the time reading it in law school and being shocked just because I would no more have shot a burglar running out of a house because he's at the fence line and might hop the fence. It just would not have occurred to me.
Yes.
And I was pretty shocked by the holding. However, it's a really, to me, and I'm curious what you think, Serge, it to me is a much closer call for Detective Ellaby in Baltimore City with this young man running with the gun.
It's not even a close call to me.
Why?
And I'll tell you why. So he's running with a gun.
It's a close call to me, Serge. Listeners told you this week, somebody wrote to you and said they wish we would disagree more.
When you say something that I don't agree with, I got to disagree.
There you go.
So here's the thing. Let's say he's running with this handgun And his adrenaline's pumping, as is the cops, right?
Right.
So all it takes, as we know, because bullets have no name, is for him to turn around and fire an errant shot. Could hit the cop, could hit a kid, could hit some old lady in her kitchen. Now, that's first of all. Second of all, what if he comes across a five-year-old girl who's turning the corner as he's turning the corner? I guarantee you his adrenaline is going to cause him to do something he may not mean, but he will regret. And so probably would the police officer if he doesn't take a swift, immediate action. And I was just reading a story within the last couple weeks about a case in Florida where a 13-year-old armed with a gun was running from the police. He turns the corner because he was probably faster than the cop was. You know, cops nowadays, they're not in the best
shape. I
was
faster at 13.
Yeah, so he turns the corner as the cop rounds the corner, adrenaline pumping. The 13-year-old had taken a tactical position on one knee.
I remember.
And fired at the officer, striking the officer. They wound up apprehending the 13-year-old, but that doesn't do the officer any good, doesn't do his family any good now. His whole department, everybody knows him now, probably has PTSD. So when people say this, it's because they've never done it. They've never been taught what to do. They've never seen, or they forget what the outcome could be. So I'm sorry, I've got to disagree. In this case, a guy running with a handgun, something we were taught in the academy years ago. If you can articulate, now, if you're running on a football field and you both start around the 10-yard line and you could clearly see that there's no place he could go for a tactical advantage, then that's different. But we're talking about in a neighborhood where he can bend, where he did bend a corner.
I was about to say, just to let our listeners know, he was going down alleys. He was turning corners.
Yes.
Right. He was clearly trying to gain tactical advantage.
Absolutely.
Or escape. I'm not sure which.
Absolutely. But, yeah. Well, he was more than likely trying to escape. And I'm going to say that because never did he even point the gun back at the cop that we saw in the video.
Right.
But at the very least, he's trying to escape. And let's unveil the elephant in the room. We're talking about West Baltimore, okay, in a city that's experienced 300 plus murders in the last decade. So
in the last decade, in case there's somebody not from Baltimore.
300 plus murders per year.
Right.
In the last decade.
Right.
So I don't think he was going to hunt deer with that gun with the extended magazine, Clark, if you understand what I'm saying.
I do, but the reason I think it's a closer call is this, and this is my bias, just bias meaning life experience.
Okay.
I think that he was as likely to be getting ready to discard the gun if he thought he could get away from the police officer long enough to throw it down a sewer without being seen. I think that there's a lot of that goes on in the city as well.
What year was that gun stolen?
2021.
Do you really think his intention was to get rid of it?
I think it's quite possible, yes.
I don't think it was possible at all. Or he would have dropped it and kept running. The cop would have had to stop and secure the gun. Think about it.
I think that's a valid point, but I think that the issue for the...
And he knew who the kid was. So the kid was almost certain that the cop would have stopped to secure the gun.
As a matter, let me just jump ahead. Serge is making a very valid point.
I always make valid points, Clark.
When they shot this young man...
Mm-hmm.
And
he was a criminal at this point, Clark.
He's a criminal.
Stop calling him a young man. Kind of like what PM Smith said on our episode. There is juvenile delinquency and there is behavior that makes you a criminal.
Okay.
And what he was doing was criminal behavior.
I have no problem with that.
Armed with a stolen gun.
So when this young criminal armed with a stolen gun was laying prone on the ground having been shot.
Yes.
And the officer stopped to give him first aid. The officer had to interrupt his first aid. Because a crowd formed around the weapon, and the officer had to secure the weapon.
Absolutely.
So I think you're 100% right that the officer would have to stop based on his training and secure the weapon. Here's the Tennessee versus Garner problem. The United States Department of Justice wrote a scathing report, which ultimately ended with the consent decree, where they decried the police officers chasing these people on foot in Baltimore, specifically saying that it increased the possibilities of use of force. And so this officer, I don't know what's going to happen to him, but I would not want to be in his shoes right now, because although if I were to predict, handicap the case, I think he's not going to be indicted, but I'm not positive he won't be indicted either by the state system, by our state's attorney, or federally by the Department of Justice, because he did shoot a young man, criminal, in the back as he was fleeing and apparently not pointing the firearm at the police officer. And in terms of the errant shots, unfortunately, it was the police officer who threw some errant shots. The police officer fired four shots. We know that one, at least one, struck the young man, but the others may have just gone down the street. So what are your thoughts on that, Serge? Is the officer going to be in any trouble?
Well, you know, nowadays I don't even pretend to be able to call that. But I don't think he should be. And for the reasons that I cited, I feel like to say, simply because you don't want to hurt people's feelings by using force, you then say, let the criminal, because this guy was armed with a gun. This isn't like he was suspected of being armed with a gun. He was armed with a gun. So you let the criminal get away with the gun and continue his criminal behavior. Or do you address the criminal, use enough force as necessary, and protect and serve? Because that's what essentially their job is, even though I don't think the commissioner of Baltimore City thinks the job of the police is to protect and serve. That's what the people pay taxes for.
Serge, at the beginning of the video, the body-worn camera, there's a point where it appears that the officer is sitting on a stoop in Baltimore, like he was just talking to some young people.
Yes.
I can't recall if his hands are visible. And the reason I'm asking that is, do you know with certainty what the race of the officer is?
I believe his hands were visible. If you watch, you see his hands almost open. He has a watch.
That's
on.
That's my point. I just couldn't remember.
Okay. African-American.
Okay.
Yep.
If he were Caucasian, same set of facts, do you think we'd have protests in Baltimore right now and a lot of civil unrest?
Well, I think that they released the video quickly enough that there may not have been, but who knows? Because he did shoot the kid in the back. And then you had citizens saying, if you've seen the news coverage from early on, that they didn't see a gun,
right,
that he was always harassing the kid. I even heard where the police supposedly recovered the gun from a backpack he was carrying before the video came out.
That's another important point, is that the mother of the young man who was shot gave a police interview saying this police officer had a history with her son
of harassing this
young man.
Yes.
And the police commissioner pointed out that a search of the Baltimore City police records found no complaint, suggesting that may be not true.
And remember, Clark Ellers, while I wasn't initially a huge fan of body cameras, we did an episode on it, and this here is a perfect example of—
I couldn't agree with you more.
The body camera saving the city money, possibly saving the city a riot. So—
Yes, it's very— matter of fact,
we're on the body camera train, Clark.
The police commissioner and his staff, when they were giving this presentation to the press, they froze the body camera and circled.
Yes.
And you'd have to be blind not to see that this young man was carrying a gun.
And I think I'll criticize the commissioner or anyone else, I'll also give them kudos when they deserve it. I think he did a good job in releasing the video in a timely manner and explaining. And he—
one thing he did too that I thought was very, very good, Serge.
What's that?
Is that he gave the officer credit for the initial contact. He said the officer engaged—
doing what we want them
to
be doing.
Correct, correct. Yep. And I thought, man, that to me carried a lot of weight. Go ahead, sir.
No, I'm agreeing with you. And it alerted the public to the fact that in this case, when he sees what's right, he's going to stand behind his officer. So I said, kudos to the commissioner in this case.
Totally.
Kudos to him.
I agree completely. Now, Serge, opinion and, well, solutions. In other words, can I go first on this, sir?
Go first, Clark. And I promise I won't interrupt you unless I disagree.
There you go. I think police officers need a bright line policy. This is what I mean by that. I think that police commissioner, the mayor, anybody on the city council with some integrity, citizens and others need to push back against the Department of Justice and the consent decree, and to a certain extent, the chief judge of the United States District Court, who's monitoring the consent decree on behalf of the United States, and start to say to the Department of Justice and the chief judge, look, think of the point Serge made. We can't have 17-year-olds with guns and extended clips running through our streets in broad daylight.
Broad daylight.
Yeah, this is crazy. And we need to bring back what the Supreme Court said is absolutely lawful conduct, the stop and frisk, and we need to back these guys up. And here's where we need the bright line. We need a policy that says what the police are supposed to do if you have reasonable grounds that a person is suspicious and they run. Yes or no. Do the police pursue them or not? This is the stupid Department of Justice report saying it might lead to a use of force, to me, is a disincentive to police officers pursuing them. And this officer, Detective Ellaby, in my mind, ought to be commended
absolutely
for pursuing. Now, we next need a bright line on what do you do if during the pursuit, the person produces a handgun, clearly produces a handgun. Do you stop? Do you shoot? Do you simply run on foot until he begins shooting and then shoot? Yeah, I'm not kidding when I say the detectives and the officers, they deserve a policy because they're putting, in my mind.
And the citizens deserve a policy, yes, that they can put their hands on, that is something that they can understand.
Or agree to. They run the government. The
absolutely
citizens are the people responsible to elect these officials.
Absolutely.
So we need to say to the government what we want. And if we want nothing, then we have to be ready to live with these consequences of nothing.
And not complain.
Correct. In other words,
when we get nothing.
The young man was running. The officer pursued. He produced a gun. The officer did what he's been trained to do. He stopped immediately and let the armed criminal continue on his merry way.
Absolutely.
I'm being serious. Or alternatively say, force is appropriate in these circumstances, and we're going to 100% back the detective when they... or officer, when they use force in these circumstances.
And you know who we're leaving out, kind of conspicuously have left out? The media, Clark Ollers.
I know.
Because the media, I shouldn't have to read this, what the characteristics of an armed gunman are, or armed person are, to the citizens that the media are supposed to be serving.
One of the things, and I'm not really trying to single out a single television station or reporter. But one of the things that so annoyed me at the press conference was, here's the police commissioner, and the questions are, was he shot in the back? Was he shot in the back?
Did he shoot first?
Correct. Because it was all about the narrative being the police officer shot this citizen in the back.
Yep.
And I actually thought the commissioner's answer, because to me, I think the answer is yes. It certainly appears to me that he shoots the man in the back.
And I think that's what they had gotten from the hospital, that he had been at least one entry wound was to the back.
And the video seems to
show. Yes, but this was before the video. Remember,
oh, okay.
People were, yeah.
But one of the things I thought was kind of amusing is Commissioner Harrison said, we're not sure what the entrance wound and what the exit wound is, which I thought was actually kind of amusing. Like, he was just saying, okay, we have two holes in him. We can't tell if
because
it's front to back or
exactly
back to front.
Exactly. They're asking questions. Now, see, I thought he handled that in a classy way.
So did I.
Again, kudos to the commissioner.
But I also think that the reason I'm challenging the reporter on that is I believe that was intended to get an answer of provocation, meaning we're going to now do nightly news,
yep,
news at 7, you know, detective shoots child in the back, child under 18, you know, running from him in Baltimore.
And the commissioner isn't being transparent. News
correct
at 11.
Correct. And so that to me is what I anticipated
yes,
coming.
Yes, yes.
And thankfully, we haven't gotten to that point on this particular story.
Absolutely.
Serge, believes the young man. I'm sorry, I was going to summarize. I think you believe that the office detective should not be charged. Now, what is your belief about whether he will be charged?
I don't think that Ivan Bates will charge him, because I think that he has been around long enough to know that it's unacceptable for a 17-year-old to be running around in broad daylight armed with a handgun.
Politically, too, Ivan Bates just went down to the General Assembly to have the law changed for more time.
Absolutely.
So if he's going to be true to his politics,
he gets it. And as long as he can stand firm and not let anybody get to him, because I'm not sure what the powers that be might think who are over him, but I don't think he'll charge him. So that's why I say I don't know what the federal government might do.
This is my prediction, Serge.
Yes.
My prediction is entirely, first of all, at the state level, I agree with you. I don't believe the state's attorney from Baltimore City. My prediction would be that they will not charge the detective.
Yes.
And actually, the investigation these days, we're saying state's attorney for Baltimore City, but actually the investigation of police shootings is now done by the attorney general's office.
And they declined to investigate this one.
Oh, I didn't realize that. Okay, very interesting. All mm-hmm. right. So in any event, it will be Ivan Bates' decision then.
Yep.
Or a grand jury's decision.
Mm-hmm. But I don't think the officer will be indicted. I'd almost bet.
This is what I have to say about the Department of Justice.
Yes.
Citizens, wet your finger, put it in the air in Baltimore City, and see which way the political wind is blowing. That's how much faith I have in the Department of Justice. If national figures in the I guess I'll call it race-conscious world of politics mm-hmm. and religion, if they become involved, I think the officer detective may be indicted federally. If they don't become involved, if this story goes no further than the Baltimore Sun and WJZ local news, I don't think the detective will be charged. But I am cynical to the point of wet your finger, put it in the air for the political winds, because I think that's what the Department of Justice is these days. I think they make political decisions, not decisions based on the law.
Absolutely. I agree.
Well, thank you all for listening. I want to publicly thank Serge for the honor he bestowed on our family by acting as a pallbearer in my mother's funeral, and I thank him very much for that.
You're welcome, Clark Hours.
God bless him.
But life is never easy. There's work to be done and obligations to be met, obligations to truth, to justice, and to liberty.
This podcast is the copyrighted property of Black and White and Thin Blue Lines Incorporated, a Maryland corporation. Any rebroadcast of the podcast without the written permission of the owner is prohibited. For more information, we invite you to visit the website blackandwhiteandthinbluelines.com. All of the words in the URL address use common spelling and are typed together with no spaces. We hope you've enjoyed this podcast, and we welcome your remarks through email. The email addresses of the co-creators, Serge Antonin and Clark Ollers, may be found on the website.